One of the things that is sometimes criticized about particularly the early yogic traditions, what we call classical yoga traditions. So this is early Buddhism. This is the traditions coming out of the Upanishads, including Patanjali's yoga system, which is very Buddhist related, but also including like the systems of Vedanta, early Vedanta in the Bhagavad Gita, and this whole realm of practice that crosses between Buddhist and Hindu and proto-Hindu and Jain practice in the early years, all of these systems are oriented toward quieting the senses, calming the fluctuations of the mind or the passions, working with strong emotion in a releasing kind of way toward a liberation that is profoundly unhinged, unhooked from grasping, from fear, from aversion. But one of the criticisms that many of these traditions received was they seemed to focus entirely on the individual. I don't think they did, actually, partly because all of these systems were taught, by and large, and practiced in intentional community. They were never just something that, like, I shouldn't say never. Certainly there were lone wolves. But the bulk of the Jain systems, the Buddhist systems, the proto-Hindu or early Hindu systems were monastic, were folks living in the wilderness together, speaking of retreat, together, eating together, sitting together, studying together. And when the Buddha talks about the benefits the conditions needed to be in place for practice to be successful, he very often talks about community, about friendship. He says, you know, that the whole of the holy life is the spiritual friend, the presence of the spiritual friend, by which he means both the community of your peer practitioners and very much the teacher as spiritual friend, someone who can show you the way, a wise guide. So so nevertheless, the critique came from other systems, particularly from somewhat later systems, and very much from the later tantric systems, that these early bodies of theory and practice were, we would say, solipsistic or narcissistic. They were really about the individual separate from everything else, and that the full liberation consists, in a sense, of an even deeper separation, like dissolving into nothingness or disappearing from the world of birth and death. What I want to propose is that this isn't true at all, with a couple of things as evidence, and then kind of a model for how we might understand ourselves as embedded in the entirety of the cosmos in about 15 minutes. I spoke of this recently, I think in a question or sometime. We were talking about karma. We were talking about reincarnation a couple weeks ago. And one of the strongest statements in the early Buddhist texts that speaks to a chain of rebirths, a chain of connected links between bodies over time, is the insight that the Buddha has, that Gautama, young Gautama, has on the night of his liberation, his realization. He has three insights, and the first of them is the insight into his own past lives. He sees himself in 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 past lives. First of all, cosmic time, right? This is a myth that speaks in cosmic time. It talks about, you know, remembering millions of past lives. So this happens very quickly. He says he did it in the first watch of the night, which I think means like 9 o'clock to midnight, something like that, or, you know, dark to midnight, or whenever the watch is, watchmen. Who watches the watchmen? That's a comic book reference. Just, it's a Gen X comic book reference. Go look it up. So he does this in a matter of hours with very strong concentration. And what he sees is a succession of identities, in a way, who were born in a certain place, ate a certain kind of food, did certain things, passed away, and was reborn in another place, in another body. So this is a really clear passage describing this. But what I want to sort of dream into about it is that one of the things that it talks about is in a sense how this chain of individuals is embedded in their place in community. Right? There's a recognition that each of these bodies is social in a certain way. It's born in a certain place. It has a certain occupation. It has a certain family, which means caste, color, class, status, gender, species. Right? There's all the stories of the Buddha being born as animals of various kinds or as deities. In a different text, it says that the Buddha had been Saka, the king of the gods. This is the parallel to the Vedic god Indra. Many different times. That's a wild thing to say, because Indra is God for a very long time. Like for an entire world system, there's this one deity. But in the Indian system, the gods are not beings who are forever that, like the Christian god who's always God. Indra is almost like an office, and you could get reborn as Indra, right? Indra dies at the end of this world system, is reborn as something else. The gods always fall at the end of their system because they haven't practiced, because it's really hard to practice when things are so pleasurable and you're so powerful. Privilege. It's really hard to practice in heaven. There's not enough suffering. But you can get born in those offices if you have some momentum that points you in that direction. So the Buddha has been Indra many times. So we're talking about not just millions of lifetimes within this universe, but millions of universe, whole world systems going back forever in this kind of vast mythic time span. So then what we get is this sense of ourselves, whatever that means, put that in big quotation marks, as being not one thing, right? These myths, if you kind of think of them together, they point to not really individuals being individuals. What is the Buddha if he's been the king of the gods, a dozen times, and ordinary people a gazillion times, and a wise, a sage a bunch of times, and a wise, kind of tiger or rabbit or monkey king, over and over and over. What is individuality at this point? And the later traditions, the Mahayana or Great Vehicle Tradition, would take this hint it's kind of hinted at in the early texts, and they would go full psychedelic on this thing with Buddha lands universes, essentially, with radiant beings, uncountable numbers of them. They really would just lean into this everybody has been everybody thing, until there's a Tibetan tantric teaching that says, it's a loving kindness teaching, essentially. It says you should be kind to people because this is kind of mythic mathematics, so wrap your head around this. Over the course of an infinite span of time already, everybody you know has been at some point everybody else's relation. In other words, we have all been each other's children, we've all been each other's parent, we've all been each other's enemy and murderer, we've all been each other's lover, we've all been each other's partner in different ways, we have all been everybody to everybody else. That's a wild vision of who we might be, And what it does is it does, our idea of reincarnation gets way too linear, right? We're like, oh, I was this, I was that. But this teaching, like the implications of that, if time is infinite, and it is in the Buddhist system, is, and it sort of is in most systems, just in different ways. The implication of this is not that we've been, that we are the sort of arrow tip of a long thread of individuals way back, but actually that we are like the momentary coalescing of a drop of water out of a cloud of dewdrops. And it's like it's just a flash of a moment when we are this bounded drop. And then it just goes on being everything else. Then, of course, if we look at our own boundaries, they're pretty porous. And so it turns out that there's not even so much of a bounded drop to hook onto. So I'm going to propose a model for how we might think about this without just kind of losing it in cosmic exaggeration, which I think is cool but doesn't help much. Mm-hmm. And by help, I mean like figure out what to do with your angst, your pain, your warming planet, you know, your race, your sex, your gender, your power dynamic. What do we do with reality, basically, where it seems like we're separate, seems like there's difference, there is, and we have to do something in relation to it. What I want to propose is that in the way that in our personal system we can discern these fluctuating states that we've been talking about as we've been talking about trauma and the nervous system, so I can discern that, you know, there's activation when conditions shift toward feeling threatened, and there's deactivation when the conditions shift toward feeling safe again. And then I can perceive that all of the experiences that are unfolding that I'm aware of, that they're connected in a kind of karmic stream. I can feel how today's worry is connected to last week's worry, to the worry of myself at 15. I can tell how my feeling of not belonging today is connected to a gazillion other times I felt not belonging, etc. And explained by biographical stories, all the things, I was adopted, therefore I don't belong. Like, you can, everything that we find in therapy is essentially like stitching together the karmic map, the narrative of myself. And in some way, the text talks about how I bear, in an individual way, some of the karma of my individual actions, right? When I was a teenager, I stole a bunch of Dungeons & Dragons dice from my good friend, David. I'm sorry, David. And then, when confronted about it, because it was obvious that they were his, I totally lied. And we didn't stay friends very long, and I totally lost track of him. Funny how that works, when you steal things from your friends and lie about it. So, you know, what is karma in relation to something like that, right? It's all sorts of things. Partly it's that I'm saying it right now, and I still remember it. Because there were hella nice things that we did that are just gone. Because I kind of stitched them into the, this should be normal, therefore they're not, it's not interesting. It didn't hook me. But I got hooked by negativity, which is mostly what we do. Right? The things that really hook us in the past are either ecstatic highs that probably got dramatic at some point, which is really where the hook happened, or all the mistakes. Right? And we hook, all the mistakes hook us. And that's karma. That's what it is that like we do something, it's ethics-based, the whole system is ethics-based. We do something and it stays with us. That's the individual version. So the Buddha's second insight was how beings progress according to their actions. Right? If your actions are violent through this life, violence will tend to surround you. And then the proposal is it does so in subsequent lives, in an individual kind of way. There are other texts, however, that say that karma is not just individual, and that there are things that are, you know, ecosystem-wide, like natural disasters, that are not anybody's karma. If you get caught in an earthquake, it is not your personal karma to have gotten caught in there, right? The infant who dies of cancer, it is not their personal karma necessarily that that happened. Right? There are plagues and diseases and things that are way bigger than the individual that beset us, that are not explainable by individual actions. This is really, really important, because that's one of the most painful questions about karma, is that, like, is every bad thing I experience a result of my individual actions? And it would be too extreme to say yes. The Buddha says, no, it's not like that. It's much more complicated than that. Right? There's all the other conditions. And what the other conditions are is things bigger than the individual. So here's a little hierarchy that works for me. This is not a list from the early texts. I think it's implied. But in terms of a simplification of the levels of reality for us, here's a proposition. There's individual experience, and the karmic thread or momentum of actions, ethical actions, that unfolds through the perspective of the individual. But none of us are actually an individual completely, right? We have some identity as an individual, and we have, I'll call the next circle out, family, like blood family. We all were born from somebody, right? And some bodies, most likely, with a few interesting exceptions nowadays. And so we have family, whether it's intact or dispersed, whether it's traumatic or supportive, we have it. And we have an identity that is family identity, right? My family, we are this kind of people or that kind of people, which could be like, we're descended from the Pennsylvania Dutch, or it could be, you know, well, we always have fish on Friday because we're Catholic. Like, that's a family identity. Being Catholic is more than a family identity. That's another layer. But family is like, who are we, my exact people? And families have a karma. My grandfather was Jewish and converted to Catholicism to marry my grandmother. I didn't find out about it till a couple years ago. And when I asked my dad, I was like, Dad, your dad was Jewish. You never told me. And he was like, oh, we never told you? Huh. It didn't seem like such a big deal. And I'm like, it's huge. I'm connected to all these people. That's amazing. And he was like, oh, wow, you really feel like it means something. And I'm, you know, like his response was really like blasé. And I was like, you don't just suddenly tell me I have a Jewish ancestor. It was kind of like, I was sort of thrilled and mystified and, you know. You know, but that's in our family karma. And to whatever extent, I can feel that part of my experience is connected to, like, how my father is, or how his father is, or how my mother was, or her mother, etc. I'm experiencing not an individual karmic thread, but a family karmic thread, right? I come from a long line of non-emotionally expressive men. You know, thanks, Dad, Grandpa, etc. And that's family karma, right? It's not just mine. It is mine, and it's more than mine. That's family identity. The next ring out from family I call community. So this is everyone I identify with somehow, but is further out than my blood relations. So that could be like the community of people who live in Temescal, right? I have a little identity as that. People are like, where are you from? And I'm like Temescal. That's my neighborhood. Or it's my community as, you know, I'm part of, like, the artist community. I have my artist, my dancer friends. I'm part of an academic community. All of these things that we, again, there's identity there. And now really we can say that, oh, identity is actually the feeling of being connected to a karmic thread, right? Something has hooked me that I belong to in this sequence of experiences, and I call that identity. Let's call it who I am. You know, I'm part of a queer community, I'm not part of a queer community, I'm part of an intellectual community, I'm part of a whatever we call it. And in any one of these layers, individual, family, community, there's more, we can either have a wholesome or unwholesome experience, a positive or negative experience also. You know, I can feel like I don't connect to community and I want more. I can feel like, you know, I'm really torn up about my family and I want healing. I'm really torn up as an individual and I want healing. Every one of these layers can be out of balance or in balance. And crucially, the process of liberation in the earliest systems dissolves to some extent, to a great extent, the hook of identity to any of them. This is why a lot of the old sages would say that I'm no longer a part of my family. And this is why when you become a monastic, you leave the home life for homelessness. You are no longer of your caste. You're no longer of your family. And this is in many cultures, part of monastic or hermit or renunciate practice. It's part of what renouncing is. It's renouncing membership in other communities, other family. Eventually, renouncing membership with the identity of yourself. So community is a bond of identity and connection, and there's karma in communities, right? To the extent that I'm not quite straight, I bear some of the karma that gay men bear. I'm not gay either, so I don't bear a lot of that karma, but a little bit. And when I'm in some situations, I feel that little bit, right? And again, that's not completely mine. That's just like, oh, that's in the karma of that community. Further out than community, I'll say institution. I originally just wanted to say nation, but I actually want to say more broadly institution, meaning a structure that enfolds the earlier layers. Each layer enfolds the preceding layer. So I think of individual as the center, family, community, institution, which could be nation. It could be other institutions, you know, like if I worked for a big institution, I could be part of that thing. I'm not in community with everybody in it. The thing I think of about that defines an institution rather than a community is that there are mutually held like rules or regulations that impose a kind of order that is not necessarily internally arisen. In a community, there's kind of the sense that there are mores, there are patterns, but it's less formalized. And when a community formalizes their structures, some part of it becomes an institution, or it steps out to hold more, right? With a clearer force, sometimes for the good, sometimes not. And institutions have karma. So like our country, God bless it, has karma. And it is experiencing right now, you know, the results of some past karma. And one of the, I think, liberating ways in any of these layers to reflect on or do inquiry on what's happening, because especially when things are bad, it's really hard to be like, why is it so bad? And we want to sort of pin blame. But to think of like the institution itself has history. And that history is playing out, right? Like this thing that's happening right in this exact immediate, right now, turn on the news moment about Russia is not disconnected from, you know, everything back through my lifetime and from before my lifetime about Russia. You know, that Sting song from like the darkest moment of the 80s where he has to sing, "Do the Russians love their children too?" And I'm like, what a stupid song. Like, of course they do. The fact that he would even have to sing it speaks to some profound, like, pain in the world. And so here we are again, right, with the Russians. Again, not with individual Russians, not with Russian families, not with communities within Russia, but with Russia as an institution. So this is a conflict between institutions, not between people. And so the institutions have karma that's playing out. Beyond and by the way, institutions, right, also religions, yeah, of course. Part of what we are all exactly doing right now is playing out the karma of the Buddha giving instruction to his monks to travel in all directions, not even two together, to spread the Dharma for the sake of beings' liberation. So this is an evangelical religion. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be here doing this. Because it wouldn't have come to me, necessarily. Right? Very, very different. Hinduism, not so much an evangelical religion. Right? Much more of a community and institution identity. But not trying to spread itself. So, not hardly so many Hindu converts around. Although, every once in a while, someone doing yoga gets the bug and goes all the way. Bigger than institution, mostly I want to just say ecosystem, where the planet, and again, I first wanted to say planet, but then the ecosystem of our planet is actually bigger than the planet, right? At some point, the sun is going to burn out. That's part of our ecosystem. It's a very important part of our ecosystem. So all of the institutions and those power structures are in relation to layers of ecosystem, to natural resources, to how the institutions and communities and families and individuals relate to the ecosystem. And the ecosystem itself has karma. Right? And we want to be really clear about what that is. Right? It's like the fact that the planet is warming might be the ecosystem's karma, but it's more likely institutions' karma. But what I want to say about this is that, for instance, there's this thing called the jet stream. It hurtles warm water around the Atlantic Ocean. And it developed at some point a very, very long time ago. As part of the playing out of the ecosystem through the fluctuations of ice age and warming and ice age and warming over a very long time, this lovely thing called the jet stream develops. Because the jet stream develops, this island chain way to the north of Europe that should be really cold, it's close to it crosses into the Arctic Circle, turns out to be quite temperate and lovely. Bonnie old England, we call it. And because of that, and particular kind of conditions, it's being isolated from the continent, invasions, Vikings, Saxons, Normans, many different things. A huge empire develops there. That empire spreads out around the world, conquers most huge chunks of the world, brings resources back, causes hella destruction and colonial misery, and all of that resource gets funneled into this profound amount of technological progress called the Industrial Revolution. And they realize that you have to burn hella shit to make more shit happen. And so So there's some way that if we can trace, for instance, humans' ridiculous leap forward into technology and burning stuff as a consequence of a particular confluence of conditions that were planetary, then in an interesting way we can say that the planet is experiencing the result of its own fluctuations. It would be, it's always a mistake, and it's a really interesting mistake to track, I think a lot of the big mistakes we make are to assign blame to the wrong layer. So like, you know, I think I'm just like really messed up, but what I should be looking at is my family, right? Or I think my family's really messed up, but what I should be looking at is, you know, the karma of my community or race or nation or, you know, whatever you call the next layer out. And so then we could say, it would be a mistake to say, oh, because the planet had some karma, it created a jet stream, and it knoweth not what it did by having a jet stream. That, like, it brought this on itself. You know. That would be getting the layer wrong. And this is hard to defend logically, because in a certain way we could say, well, it did. The hinge in this whole thing, I think that's very interesting, and I'm not going to even try to explain it, but I'm going to say that there's a piece in here that is the, or I'll explain it in another week, because now we want to chat together. But there's this whole process of karma which seems like impersonal phenomena rolling on, massive web of conditions, layers of karma influencing each other and rolling on. There's this one profound, interesting thing in the mix. The Buddha would refuse to say that everything is determined by karma, because there's this one mysterious thing that crops up in what's called sentient beings, or beings with a mind, heart, and that's choice. Some beings actually make conscious choices. And the ones that we're most familiar with are us. Species karma. We have a certain kind of sentience where we can make choices in relation to observation. And ethics is a sentient, like, structure. There's not really ethics per se in the animal world or the deity world. There is in the deity world. It's not in the animal world or the ghost worlds or the ecosystem world. And it's an interesting question to ask, this is again just a footnote, whether ethics exists, which level of this system does ethics primarily exist in? And I would say I think it's supposed to be a communal thing more than an institutional thing. And that's actually an argument between, you know, Democrats and Republicans right now, among many others. Which level of this system should ethics be applied to? Is it just an individual choice? That's kind of the libertarian view, right? Does it live in families? That's a very kind of Christian conservative view. Does it live in communities? That's a little bit more of a kind of anarchist communal kind of view. Does it live in institutions? That's law and order. Right. Or is it a natural law in the ecosystem? That's in some ways the Buddhist or religious view, that ethics is beyond us, that it's in the fabric of the universe itself, because ethics is karma. That's why karma is called the natural law, or the dharma is the natural law. It actually lives, the Buddha says, in the ecosystem, and then that enfolds everything else. So, layers of identity, layers of cause and effect. Part of our practice can be to discern which layer we're attending to as we do our work, so that we can clarify where and how the intervention is needed. Right? We can't do communal work internally alone, because it exists in the ring of community. It has to be done in community. We can't do institutional work alone. We also can't do institutional work just from the layer of community. All of the layers respond primarily to themselves. And then it takes a certain kind of wisdom to see what, to distinguish what's happening in the various. So may we see clearly the layers of our own rebirth, moment to moment, body to body, and then the echo of the past in all the layers that we encounter. So, pause there. Take a moment to let it do what it does. And particularly because the map of these kind of layers is a bit of an extrapolation of mine. I'm not alone in it, but it's not specific to the early Buddhist texts, as is some of what I offer you. So I'm just curious about your reflections and what appears for you when you think about these this kind of a model.
Okay, then, yeah. One thing I thought of was, I read that the metals that make, like, building, you know, computers and a lot of the more advanced technology that we have now possible are only accessible to us because of the formation of the moon. Like,
yeah.
Something hit the earth and the impact drew up metals from the core, which otherwise wouldn't have been accessible to anybody on the crust.
Your phone vibrates because at some point a chunk of the moon collided with the earth.
Yeah.
Right on.
So I just think about, like, all of the you know, implications of technology, the social implications of, you know, so many people having smartphones, and I was talking with a friend about how, like, there's, you know, the younger generations, like, are use emoticons so often that they aren't, I mean, I read another article about how they have trouble expressing themselves without them.
Yeah.
And that sort of, like, this, you know, pictograph language is now developing out of that. And
sure. There's a movie, right? The Emoji Movie.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I saw that on the bus today. Sure.
What's that?
I'm going.
You're going, totally.
I'm going.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
The subtitles are for anyone over 20, basically.
So, yeah. Like, you know, like, that's karma in action.
It is. It is. And it's a good example, because you could take something like the phone and you could analyze it in a way on any of the levels. So, like, on the individual level, we could talk about screen addiction, you know, and like, I don't know, you know, radiation on my butt because I keep it in my pocket, like, whatever. And then on the family level, we can talk about, you know, the family dinner table and, like, kids resorting and the dissolution of family bondedness, the aspects of that that are connected to the devices. Mm-hmm. We could talk about it on the level of community and how school is different and communal space is different because of these devices. We could talk about the legalities and regulation of them. And the layers intersect, because, like, there's an ecosystem level that you're speaking about. Oh, this is like some crazy mineral, right? And then that hint, these are very rare minerals, rare earth minerals, that connects down through the institutions to the communal level when we get geopolitical and we find out that the very mineral that makes the phone vibrate is only mined in one particular place in Central Africa, and it has destroyed the country. And so then there's, like, oh, there's the ecosystem level, there's all these other levels, and there's, you know, colonialism and resource, you know, all of that is there. Part of you can take anything and you look through all the levels of it, and you'll see the threads of it, how it manifests in each place. And so many of people's specializations, you know, commentaries are really just folks who, like, see something really clearly on one particular level, and you could just write about that. You know, I just want to write about the phone at the family dinner table. And it just takes that one little slice and plays that out. I'm just going to write about the Central African Republic and play that out. You know. Yeah.
I've been listening to a lot of Pima Chodron's teachings too lately, and just kind of 3 weeks ago was locked on this emotional darkness struggle, and I went right to Pima because she does all this charnel ground practice, and she talks so much about the bigger practices of community, loving kindness, and then when you're going through the layers today, what I really notice is that whenever I'm feeling stuck, the individual part is really hard for me. Like, I'm stuck in thinking about the individual part, but I don't want to think about it. It's just, it doesn't go anywhere to, like, obsess about this. And the moment anyone mentions, like, branch out, I'll settle back into that more oneness feeling, or it's really easy for me to go to the places that you're talking about, I guess is what I'm trying to say, when you talk about everyone's been everything to everyone. I'm like, yeah, of course. That part's easy. The individual part, that's where all this weird emotional clonging happens. Right? And the moment anyone's like, and I think that's what drew me to Buddhism, was the way I was raised and the way I was taught to think in this very broad global perspective by this awesome mother, family karma, sort of made it accessible to me at a young age. That stuff all feels so obvious to me, to be open to others, to have these like limitless boundaries, to have compassion and love. Like, that part's easy. It's like figuring out on an individual basis that it gets so hard. Like, thinking about Trump as an incarnation is, ugh, I feel sick. But thinking about just all the people and how everyone has similar struggles and similar desires and similar, that's easy. And then I work in, like, with animals and thinking about how all beings have kind of similar desires, that feels easy to me. So I really resonated with the layers that you were talking about and how much that unsticks things for me personally.
Yes. So, right, like moving our attention either outward through the layers or sometimes inward, moving to another layer from the one that really gets us stuck. And I think the individual is the layer that gets many of us stuck. I think it's probably why these great ancient traditions focused on it. It's not random, some historians say, that all these traditions arose at the very time that individuals were recognizing themselves as individuals. So, like, it's not like there was always people who had angst about their identity, right? Because there were whole times when, for instance, the family or tribal layer was the layer in which identity was cathected, was established strongly. And so, like, the sense of, like, an individual was just less happening. And one of the ideas about this particular time where the Buddha appears and you know, Plato and Socrates appear, and Lao Tzu and appears in China and all over the place, kind of throughout the European, Asian, South Asian spread, is the arising of these particular teachings that are not dissimilar. Is that was roughly the time when agricultural surplus was finally giving rise to cities, and the old tribal structures were being subsumed into larger institutions. And so it's hard to maintain the identity nature of a small, 100-person extended family, essentially, when you're embedded in a much bigger sea of people. And so the arising of, like, the sense of the individual coming at that time, and at the very same time as the individual arises, these models arise that say, watch out for that individual thing. It's not the truth. So they actually appear at the same time. The danger in leaving the difficult layer for an easier layer is that no layer is healed from another layer's perspective. So you have to go back to it to work it. You know this, of course. We all know this. But
actually, it's more of just, it helps to get breathing space. It's that, like,
yeah,
out for, like,
yeah,
okay, this doesn't, it matters, and it's huge, and it needs to be focused on, but it doesn't matter as much as I think it matters right in that moment. And that gives me enough, like,
That's
enough of a
absolutely
time out to, like, be able to actually address it.
Yeah.
From not a panicked, insane place.
It's, panic and insanity are rarely skillful.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
The thing that was striking me was kind of in this talk about karma is the word that keeps coming up for me is judgment around karma. And like, so one thing that stands out is that the earth or the ecosystem, you brought this on yourself. There's kind of like a judgment around that.
Totally.
And karma used as a way to explain, like, the negative circumstances.
Yeah.
And over and over again, I think often I hear that, like, it's karma. It's this is the explanation for these negative circumstances and the judgment around the negative circumstance.
Yeah.
So it feels like a judgment or like the punishment for the crime.
Right. And there are some traditional threads that, you know, that do go there in a very literal way. But your hunch, I think, is, you know, it's absolutely right that, like, that's a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, to add judgment to the thing, you know, it's the whole model is a little more thermodynamic than that. It's almost like, you know, if, like, to use the old, like, the medieval billiard ball theory, like, you know, one ball rolls along the pool table, hits another one, transfers some of its force to it. You could, as if you went to the second ball and been like, you know, oh, look what you've gotten yourself into. Now you're rolling too. You know.
Yeah.
Where the ball could be like, I got hit. I'm rolling. Like, mm-hmm. it has nothing to do with any of us.
Mm-hmm.
There's just some force that was, you know, impelled in a direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to keep going, you know, until it stops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until it gets essentially absorbed into the surrounding felt. That's a pun, right?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Into the felt sense. But yeah, it's really important in relation to kind of inquiry and analysis and healing work that looks backward in any way to see if we can tease out or separate the habit of judgment from a kind of clear seeing of what happened. Right? That's the Buddha's insight. He saw a million past lives. He wasn't like, oh, past lives number 4, 17, 19, and 2,000 through 5 million were all kind of lame. Right? He doesn't say that. He just says it just went on and on and on. And in a way, the fact that there's so many of them kills the possibility of judging any of them. It's just too infinite. You just can't, right? So you could say, how could you apply specific judgment to, you know, a given thing that is a result of an infinite process? Hopefully, inquiry in this way would have as one of its effects kind of defeating or weakening that habit that we have, right?
Mm-hmm.
To judge ourselves, to judge others, etc. Yeah, Hannah.
It seems really important to me to differentiate the part of us that is judging and comparing and the part of us that kind of differentiates human life and our ability to question, like, what is the purpose of our life? What is,
mm-hmm.
who am I? What, you know, and the word you use, choice, and just there's something that's connected with breath, that's connected with
mm-hmm.
giving birth, that's connected, you know, with the whole ecosystem that's a very mystical connection that we have access to
mm-hmm.
through, you know, these Buddhist, you know, practices or whatever
yeah.
those may be. And something about that is like very different from the part of us that contracts around,
yeah.
oh, this is my role, that I am a woman, I am a
yeah.
62, you know.
Yeah.
So I just wanted, and those don't negate each other at all. They're both living simultaneously.
Yeah.
I
think that's really important. You know, you're speaking to a kind of discernment as we know ourselves more fully, where it's not that, like, oh, I know myself and I'm just this mix of kind of bad habits and good habits and it's all kind of smooshed in together
mm-hmm.
into this one thing I call me. But to actually say, oh, I'm, there are in my actions and my experience the results of, in a certain way, many different kinds of karma, some of which are contractive or clinging or deluded, and others of which are quite clear, you know, and beautiful and open and powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in a very kind of pop way, I think a lot of what we're encouraged to do by many good kinds of spiritual practice is to discern the difference between those and, you know, upregulate the beautiful. Give, you know, create the conditions for more and more of the powerful, the clear, the good to arise.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the challenges on the path are discerning which is actually which, you know. Yeah, Peter.
Yeah. I love this stuff, you know, trying to figure this stuff, things out.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, there's a trap sort of I believe, that karma, you know, it's our natural tendency, and I think it's our ego, to figure it out.
Yeah,
this
for sure.
Terrible mystery, or this amazing, this awesome mystery, that is, or for some people it might be a terrible mystery. Why did my child get cancer, or
yeah,
a meteor come out of the sky and hit this innocent person, or whatever? And we want to figure it out, know what life, what this thing is. Life is unfathomable.
Yeah,
giant mystery. So we, you know,
we kind of
long lists of theology, these Byzantine things following all my past lives back 50 million years, and now I know, and I can somehow control and be safe from the mystery. You know, my ego wants to know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yes,
yeah. I'm scared.
Yeah.
Because this life, I, you know, what I really know is that very soon I'm going to be dead. You know,
yeah,
this body. So I'm afraid of that. My ego is afraid of it.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a little bit of a trap in the intellectualizing of that, I think.
Absolutely.
And some people just say, well, karma, what a mystery. You know, isn't it amazing,
right,
how mysterious it is?
Which is a lovely frame. It's a really useful frame. You know, the how amazing frame. Because it
the awe of it.
Yeah, totally. It helps you to not get hooked into, you know, trying to figure it out. One of the really important things about the remembering your past lives practice, I talked about it a bunch of months ago, and someone came in afterwards and was like, I really want to learn that practice. And I was like, great. Figure out how to absolutely quiet your mind and become profoundly concentrated in deep samadhi for many hours at a time in an absolutely reliable way. And then we'll put you on a series of very specific practices that eventually will lead to that. So it's a formalized practice within Buddhism to see your past lives. The teacher that I talked with about it at one point, who can do it, said, she talks in this very matter-of-fact way about profoundly deep things that almost nobody can do. But she says, you know, for most students, you only need to do kind of 3 or 4 lives back, and then you kind of get the gist of it, and you don't have to do it anymore. So I was like, cool, all right. So it is a very real practice, but the thing that's important is that it's not cognitive at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a samadhi practice, and it means being able to enter essentially the most profound states of stillness known to humanity. You know, these are the people that can do this are folks who can drop into the absolutely thoughtless, identity dissolved perception that consciousness is infinite and stay there for several hours or days. And that's extreme, right? That's not, I can't do it. Most people I know can't do it. The people that can do it are virtuosos who were pretty good at it from the beginning. So very few people, as far as I can tell, develop that from ordinary neurotic mind to that. And it's a hint, perhaps, that thing about lots of past lives developing the perfections might be true. You know, it says the Buddha became the Buddha only after a gazillion lifetimes of developing these good qualities like samadhi and kindness, etc. And it's a suggestion that, like, the suggestion is a little bit this, and maybe we'll close with this. Just the fact that you're here and interested, just the fact that you're interested in healing, just the fact that it's appealing to you at all, this whole realm of inquiry and practice, from some traditional perspectives, means you've been doing it a very, very, very long time. Like, look around you. How many people want to do this? Nearly nobody. This kind of inquiry into the nature of reality and the self. Almost nobody, relatively speaking, is even interested. And so the fact that you are, you don't own that, right? That's your karma. And it's got to come from somewhere. So maybe it's family, right? You grew up in a family who taught you to be interested in extremely rare mystical things. And maybe it's, you know, in your individual layer, maybe it's in your communal layer, whatever. But it the quality itself of being interested in the Dharma is the result of a very long, it's said, process of transformation. One teacher will even say, I can't remember who said this, it was a Tibetan teacher, who's like, oh my God, you know, you're even, just the fact that you're here, you're nearly enlightened. Right? Relative to the vast majority of suffering beings out there. Now, don't let it go to your head, right? And don't book your plane ticket yet, because
lifetimes to go.
Right. You could have, you know, 100,000 lifetimes to go, but compared to infinity, that's not very many. So just keep on...
Astronomical terms.
Right. I know, exactly. One of our teachers in my lineage, James Barras, was practicing with one of his teachers, Sri Punja, or Papaji, in Lucknow, in North India, in the late 60s, and... Really, this was a little bit later. This is like the early 80s by this point. And maybe even later. I'm getting James all wrong. Sorry, James. Getting the dates wrong. It might even have been later. But he's with Papaji, non-dual teacher. He says, he finally gets his mom to ask a question. He says, Papaji, you're always talking about this thing like grace. We don't really use that language in Buddhism. I don't quite know what you mean by grace. What is this grace thing? And Papaji just starts to laugh. And he's like, look at you, beautiful man, beautiful family, beautiful son, lots of privilege, you love the Dharma, you teach the Dharma, you travel around practicing with people, you're neck deep in it, you have so much grace, you know. Like just the fact that, like, look at your life, so much grace, you know. And but when we wander around going like, where's the grace, you know. To swing that into the political, it would be like, be grateful for your privilege, and then use it to go further. So that's beyond enough for the night. I will be here next week, come and do yogic history and philosophy with me. It's awesome. It's super fun. We'll learn whack practices that I won't teach you in here, and it starts. What's that?
Teaser.
Totally. Totally. I will teach you how to dissolve your
karma.
Something into the cosmicness of something.
It's like Mad
Libs. Just fill in.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. Blessings to you all. Your generosity is cosmically appreciated in the little tiny basket there that is larger than it seems. Come and practice. Enjoy your summer. See you soon.
Yeah.
Just take all the strawberries.